Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello and welcome to another edition of En Camino with Janie Jewson and me, Kit Hogg, this Saturday, the 25th of July. We hope you're well on this high summer morning. On today's episode, we hear from Ernest Hemingway running the bulls at San Fermín Pamplona in July of 1926, exactly 100 years ago. Why babies in Peru are being christened Erling Haaland. We bring you the eagerly anticipated winner of Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest. And in more genteel surroundings, ask, how do you behave in a restaurant? Rude questions, fussy diets, spoiled pets, mobile phones and laptops, a general sense of entitlement. Nightmare diners are everywhere, but are you one of them? And how are they coped with? On a more serious note, as of late July, over 120,000 hectares have already burned across Spain following the catastrophic fires in Almeria, where 13 people died recently. There have been major incendios in Zaragoza, Aragon and La Mierla near Guadalajara, where right now the second largest wildfire in Spanish modern history is blazing. Every summer, we steel ourselves for this litany of disaster. Although last year was a shocker, with nearly 400,000 hectares lost to flames, a check on El Diario ES yesterday shows 8 active wildfires, each in excess of 500 hectares. Are these infernos now an inevitable catastrophe of summer, something we have to learn to live with, an unavoidable scourge of increasingly unlivable heat? Or are these conflagrations, in spite of exorbitant July temperatures, at least containable with a more traditional approach to land use? Tracy Parker, equestrian expert and campo dweller, long-time resident of Andalusia, has written extensively on the subject and is our guest on this morning's Big Conversation.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Your views, of course, are always welcome. Message us on WhatsApp at 645-99-67-95. Meanwhile, a warm, and how can it be anything other than warm on this breathless morning, a warm welcome to Tracy Parker. Hi, Tracy.
Good morning, Kit. Lovely to be here.
Lovely of you to come in. It's so special to have a guest in the flesh, if you'll pardon the expression.
No.
Calm down. Tracy, a couple of weeks ago, your post on social media opened with the eye-catching and counterintuitive assertion, you don't fight wildfires in summer. Can you explain that?
Yes. The firefighting has to start long before the temperatures rise. It has to be in the preparation. It has to be in maintaining countryside. I'm going to confuse my Spanglish here with campo. Maintaining countryside, keeping borders clean and clear, making sure that families and houses, people who live anywhere that's susceptible to wildfire, are prepared long before the summer arises, long before the temperatures rise.
Mm. And how are we failing in that regard? We obviously are, but how specifically?
Well, there's many factors. I've watched the decline over 40 years of the countryside being abandoned because the city calls, there's more job opportunities, and then you have small town councils, and I say this with no qualms, who look at the countryside, the abandoned countryside, and consider it protected. It isn't. The countryside doesn't work like that. Before people took over the countryside, there were no fences, animals ran freely, they kept brush down, they kept undergrowth clear, they kept their own natural fire breaks. We fenced everything off. We've claimed it, and now it's abandoned and nobody's maintaining it. It isn't safe. It isn't preserved. It is literally open to wildfire constantly.
Mm. So we've lost the transhumance. That was the natural limpieza
exactly.
of the woodland.
And even up to 25 years ago, we still had goat herders and sheep herders that would run their flocks through the forests, through the undergrowth, keeping everything clear and clean, keeping road size, lanes, all the country tracks clear of dry growth. Mm. And now instead, if we're lucky, and I say that very much tongue-in-cheek, the local council or the regional council, they send their people out to desbrozar, brush cut. Mm. But they brush cut and they leave it all on the ground where it creates more heat and it's more risk to fire than if it was left standing.
And so it's a build-up in places of leaf mulch and all that sort of thing that actually becomes
exactly.
possibly self-igniting?
I'm not a scientist, so I wouldn't like to say yes, but I'm going to hit slightly on another aspect. It's about 15 years ago, I received an email from the Department of Agriculture, along with many other people who own horses. There'd been an EU directive sent down on telling us how we were to dispose of our manure. And it was based on Belgium's idea, which is very much an English and a German and a cooler climate, of creating manure banks. And once it's dry, then you send it off to be recycled for compost and so on. It doesn't work here in Spain. Manure absolutely self-combusts.
Wow, yes.
Keeping our manure stores here in Andalusia, the same as people in colder climes do, is wrong, 100% wrong. And this is where a lot of the problems lie. We have people making decisions for us, in particular in Andalusia, but all over Spain, that don't understand the climate here. They don't understand what is going on on our doorstep. Mm. And the people who do aren't allowed to do anything because the bureaucracy makes everything not impossible, but it makes it so long-winded. There's always a delay. They have to have permission. They have to pay a tax. A lot of people don't know what's to be done, so they just ignore it and they wait for somebody else to clear up for them.
I did read this last week about the Mijas Council saying that they couldn't remove the organic rubbish. There was too much. So they had told everybody, including the farmers, not to strim the land or any of their gardens because they weren't going to be able to dispose of the rubbish. So they're now in this tricky position, the farmers, where they've now got a fire risk on their land. They're not allowed to keep, and they know if they keep all the brush there, once they've cut it, that's a fire risk. If they leave it on the ground, it is too. And they can't throw it away. So they get fined if they caused a fire and fined if they strim, you know, if they don't cut their land.
I think this falls back to the title of my article, which I didn't know would have so much interest. You don't fight wildfires in the summer. Mm. The council should have affronted this situation in the winter. And this manner of, we've all done it here. You get your permission to burn your garden waste, which is between October and April. But then that can vary, because if it has been a dry summer, they won't grant that permission, just bog standard. A lot of people don't get the permissions, which I'm not against those people. But the reason that the permission fall in place now is because people just willingly burned. They didn't have a water source ready at hand to put out a fire if it did get out of control. But they need to stop burning. They need to make compost. They need to shred the waste and make compost, because the topsoil in general is gone. Mm. We've had so many. We had before 25, we had 4 years of drought. Everything dried up. Mm. Topsoil blew away. Mm. The small amount of fires that we had prior to that.
Yeah.
They removed the roots that are gone that hold the soil. Then when the rain comes, more washes away. And look at the rain we had this spring, this February and March.
It was incredible.
Phenomenal amount of rain. The first rainfalls, they don't soak into the ground. They just run straight off and they take everything off with it. We need to return the topsoil.
Oh, we do, absolutely, yes.
I mean, what, when it rains a lot, it's ostensibly a good thing, but it does produce a whole lot more yerba, a whole lot more growth, doesn't
it?
Yes,
totally.
And that, by now, increases the fire risk. You've written that owning campo increasingly means paying more while being allowed to do less. So this hints at the first reason for our exposure to fire, you've hinted at, is transhumance, the lack of transhumance, the existence of fences, the fact that animals aren't allowed to roam freely and graze our woodlands. But bureaucracy, how badly is that to blame? These rigid rules?
I'll give you an example. There is a gentleman who owns a huge finca not far from me. I know him very well. He keeps cattle. He owns very many hectares, and he is not allowed to clear all of his ground to cultivate forage for the cows. He's owned the property for, I would say, 50 years at least, if not more, and a large part of his property is just all scrub and shrub that the cattle don't eat, and it is a constant fire risk. He's not allowed to clear it because the municipal say it's housing various birds and pollinators, and I agree with that, but they don't provide an alternative. There is a lack of hedgerows here. Hedgerows are so important. He's not allowed to clear his land, so it's left abandoned. There's fires there. It's a fire risk. People walk through the land. They leave their litter. More fire risk. It's incredible. Where I live, I could fill a feed sack, a 20-kilo sack, literally in a 400-metre space. I can fill a 20-kilo sack full of rubbish every week from things that people leave, bottles, cans, bag packets, all these things that people just leave thrown on their way. And this is in the middle of nowhere. Mm. Yeah. This is not the highway. Yeah. This is not a town street.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they limit what you can do. Then they've put the price of IBI up for rustic properties. So people have already...
IBI is the tax they charge
rent,
on...
The rates, yes, the yes. rates. They've okay. put the rates up on rustic properties. So people can't do anything with the piece of land that they've now got to pay more money to maintain, and they can't maintain it because they can't do anything.
Because they're busy paying the IBI.
Yeah.
At some point, we have to draw a line between conservation and abandonment, haven't we? And I think the forests are a very good example of that, because you reforest an area. I mean, I don't want to use the word rewilding, because that brings a whole new complexion to the argument, but you reforest an area, but actually what happens is you get an unbelievable density of trees, such that A, you create a fire risk because of the sheer propensity of pine, for example, and B, the individual specimens aren't that great because they're super competition. So if the forest was managed, the saplings would be thinned and left spatially so that each individual stem could turn into a big,
Absolutely.
A decent tree.
Coppicing as it was done previously, or even not so technical, not so clever. I very much remember over 40 years ago when I first came as a tourist here, and I remember the first time I came in the winter, it was about October time, and I went up to Peña Blanca, Sierra Blanca, with some friends I'd made here, and there were cars and cars of families. And they were collecting the fallen wood, they were taking down smaller trees, they were cutting off lower branches, and they were clearing, picking up the pine cones to use as fire starters to take home for fire, for fuel for their homes in the winter. Mm. Nobody stopped them. No damage, no harm came of any of those forests. They continued to grow far more healthily than today. Now you're not allowed to do that.
You're not allowed to pick up fire cones and
no.
twig?
No.
Really?
Yes.
Finger wagging.
This is a total insanity.
People
and the
do
reasoning.
That. People do. That.
I do. Yes.
They do. I mean, yes. And,
of course,
I don't need to because I have trees in my own property. But otherwise, I would, and I know people do. Of course, they do. But legally, you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to. And people would. There far more people went to the campo. People don't go to the campo anymore. Mm. Families would go and they would go for a walk and a picnic. And there were far more ventas and posadas, restaurants, seasonal restaurants out in the campo that people would go to. And they don't exist anymore. Mm. So people would go out for a long walk and then a nice lunch somewhere in with whatever was seasonal food, good, wholesome, basic, simple, but good food.
And now that's only available in the controllable places, like the refugios. And,
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we've identified one of the causes of these fires is abandonment. We can lay it at the door of neglect, really. So depopulation of the campo, abandoned villages, land that is no longer tended.
I think people have reached a point where they've forgotten. Well, a lot of people today have no idea how to manage the countryside. Other people have forgotten. More still have just said it's somebody else's problem.
Like they talk about, like the rubbish is, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually only 10 to 15% of wildfires are caused by natural causes, like from lightning strikes.
Yes.
And from self-combustion. And some plants and seeds and trees actually need those wildfires, don't they?
Exactly, to propagate, yes.
Yeah, to like the pine cones to open up and pop out there. Then there's resins and all sorts of things which help to ignite those fires. And they're put out nowadays sometimes too quickly. I read this morning the smaller fires, that's quite normal, but when we get fires that are ignited by people who are irresponsible and chuck their rubbish, I mustn't get too cross, onto the ground,
fire,
and you get reflective surfaces like glass, aluminium, anything like that, and they just hurl them onto the floor
with
they
no thought,
do not
no
give
consideration.
A shite.
No.
And that is infuriating. And that's where I think, you know, a big campaign needs to get going.
Ignorance
about
is terrible.
Human responsibility.
Yep. Right.
About learning what we're doing. And there is a fine example right in front of you, a book you have written.
Oh, I was going to say that very thing.
Thank you, Janie.
Introduce us to Zappi Azzurro, yeah?
Yes, last year I wrote this book because 2025, there was more wildfires in Spain than any year since 1985. And having the first time I came to Spain was 1981. Let's not talk about my age.
I'd love to know why you came, but that's another story, probably.
And in 1985, there was no aerial cover.
Yeah.
There was far less tractors. There was far less ground cover. And yet they managed to manage and control the fires since 85 until last year. Having survived wildfire myself, having horses, knowing how important it is to take autonomy, to have a plan, having seen people try to be heroes and literally get out by the skin of their teeth from fires because they think they can outrun it, because they think they can outsmart it, I felt compelled. And so I wrote Zappi, el zorro de los incendios, Zappi, the firefox. It is absolutely geared to children because we all think we know everything. The children, it's a cliche, but the children are the future. Teach the children and they will teach us. And I've written it in Spanish and in English because then the adults can use it, those that don't speak Spanish yet. It will help with their language learning.
Yay.
But it's for children, it's very much geared so that they're not frightened of fire, so that they understand it, they have to respect it. It's all about making a plan. It's all about prevention rather than dealing in an emergency. But then it's got little things like a little mochila backpack to prepare if you do have to leave your house, how to notify the authorities if you hear of a fire. And it teaches the children a little bit about the flora and fauna of Spain and the national parks. It just touches on them because it's not a tome. It's just a try to keep it as light and to the point as possible so that then they will take an interest. They will realise how important all the flora and fauna, all the trees and the animals and the birds and the pollinators are, because bottom line, the trees provide shade, which bring down temperatures. They provide food for the animals to grow grain, to grow flowers, to grow plants that we eat. And what else do they arrive to? Not, they're not alone in this, but the foliage provides the oxygen that we breathe.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's one point in here where you say the child is actually telling the father not to throw his fag end on the ground.
Yes, yes. I mean, I just give
very
some
instructive.
Venga ya, abuelo. Yes. Because it is the children that will draw attention to these things. And so I did create a couple of little, you know, like tell your mother, oh, today is not a good day to have a barbecue, mummy, because look how strong the wind is.
Mum says, great thinking, thanks for the reminder. And Rappy says, that's it. Polite and clear. Kids teach grown-ups to
to listen.
Thank you, Jenny.
I love that. Brilliant.
And I've also put in it, like, they can, there's a certificate at the end of the book so that they can become Certificado del Guardiano del Fuego. They have become fire guardians.
And it's a beautifully illustrated book. And when is it going on sale? Where can we get it?
It's on sale now. It's available on Amazon. As I say, there's the Spanish and English version, which is Zapi el Zorro de los Incendios. I did also do it in Portuguese. I had to have help with the Portuguese. My Portuguese is not much past pastel de whatever. But so I've also done
a
Portuguese and English version, because Portugal is our next door neighbour. Yeah. You know, there is no border, and there is no border.
And they get, and the they have been known to have the odd fire in Portugal, haven't they?
You know, yes. We have a huge problem with pines here. They have a huge problem with eucalyptus there.
Okay, so let's get this title out there, and maybe TRA can put it on their website as well.
That would be fabulous.
It's Rapi a Raposa do Fogo. Am I reading the wrong one?
I'm reading the Portuguese one.
Sorry, I don't read Portuguese. Okay, you tell us about
it. Zapi with a Z. Zapi el Zorro de los Incendios. Zapi the Firefox. I'm sure if you hashtag Zapi the Firefox, you will come across it, but it's available on Amazon.
Okay.
Like I said, I created it to bring awareness, because it is so important. When you've lived through wildfire, you can speak from the soul. The noise, it is a demon with the most mighty roar that rushes, and it does go right through to your soul. It really, really does. It is an incredible, incredible beast.
And once it's over, it's not over, because there are all the fumes, the carbon in the air, the effect it has on our lungs, our entire environment. It's so urgent.
Totally.
We start to listen and do something about it. And I want people to buy this book.
Okay, Zapi the Firefox. Tracy, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad it's an emotive subject that I'm glad that we've brought dialogue to it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we must do more. Really enjoyable. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
And very informative.
We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back with the En Camino news after these messages.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
You're listening to En Camino on Talk Radio Europe. It is 11:31 and it's time for our roundup of the vital global events. Yes, time for En Camino news. Following the success of Norway's World Cup, the National Identity Register of Peru now boasts 560 new baby Haalands, of whom 91 are born the full noise, Erling Haaland. The original Erling Haaland, of course, scored 7 goals in the World Cup, including the decisive strike that knocked Brazil out of the World Cup. And maybe it was this giant slaying of Peru's annoying neighbour that led to the sudden rash of baby Haalands. Except that Ivan Torres of Peru's National Registry of Identification and Civil Status says football stars set the trend in Peru when it comes to names for newborn boys. Actually, Brazil notwithstanding, it is the name Neymar that is the undisputed leader with 33,809 namesakes. There are 3,402 Peruvians called Messi, of whom 292 are registered as Lionel Messi. There's 1,185 Cristiano Ronaldos and 1,241 Peruvian Lamine Yamals. So Erling Haaland on just 560 has a bit of catching up to do. Janie.
Good job the Messi's surname weren't McCleanup. I have an awful sense of humour.
That's really funny, Jenny.
Yeah, hilarious. Okay, I only heard about this yesterday from a very lovely Spanish lady, that without air conditioning, one can cool one's house by washing or mopping your tile, marble or terracotta floors with cool or cold water in the morning. It's a traditional Spanish method for use to help lower indoor temperatures. Did you know that?
I'm not blown away by that, Janie. I would have thought it would, now you come to mention it, yes, it's a brilliant idea. I should get on it immediately.
Well, I did think about that this morning, and I was thinking,
terracotta soaks up the water.
It's
a bit like that earthenware flower pot we were talking about last week. That is much, yes. It's much better. It retains the water, the moisture, much better than a plastic one.
But also a hot marble tile, or one that's actually glazed, would also hold the heat. And I thought about it this morning. I thought, would that make a difference in my house? And I think it would if I washed my floor with cold iced water. I'd never heard of it before, but anyway, that was my exciting
tip.
Make
sure you don't skid over and hit your coccyx or something.
Well, then you wouldn't need to do it anymore, would you? Because you wouldn't be around.
You may have seen something about rapturous reception given to La Selección Española on their return to Madrid as worthy world champions. A welcome that will go on for a while, no doubt, when midfield stars Fabián Ruiz and Gavi returned to their hometown, Los Palacios y Villafranca, near Seville this week. The locals congratulated them with tomatoes. Lots of tomatoes. Yes, tomatoes famously from the renowned tomato growers of Los Palacios, who donated the body weight of each player in the gourmet variety Bonbon Colorado to the body weight of each player. So, which is to say that Fabián Ruiz received 84 kilos of tomatoes.
Oh, they're not tomatoes that got thrown at them.
When I first read this, I thought, yes.
Okay.
Because there's a tomato festival in Valencia where everyone just gets silly with tomatoes.
Yeah.
It's extremely messy. But no, and the slighter Gabby got 68.5 kilos of tomatoes presented in crates in front of the town hall.
What is their response to this? I mean, do they make it into a lot of gazpacho or something?
I imagine you give it to your mum and your aunties and your... Yeah.
Oh, God,
and
poor women.
Loads of gazpacho, yeah.
Dear God, yeah. Right, OK. That's my lot. I don't have any more trivia and snippety-gibbets today.
No more flibbity-gibbets from Jody. Well, let me tell you about an unfortunate event at the French Embassy in Yerevan, which is the capital of Armenia. So planning an embassy event, Janie, can you get your head around that? You're part of a diplomatic attaché, yeah, and you're in an embassy and you want to throw a party.
I would imagine you probably know a bit about that, coming from where you do, having had an admiral...
From Galsine?
No, you had an admiral as a father, didn't you?
Military
he lived
attaché,
in Canberra.
Yeah. No, I was never allowed there, though. No, that was... Anyway, it can be a bit of a stressful business. A lot of prestige at stake. I mean, what if the lighting is wrong and everyone ends up looking like a ghost from a 1960s horror movie, or the B-list actor? The embassy specifically requests bails at the last minute. But whatever diplomatic horror scenario you're playing over in your mind right now probably isn't as bad as what recently went down at the French embassy in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, on July the 14th.
Right.
Which, as you know, Janie, is...
10 days after July the 4th.
Correct. But why is that important to the French?
Oh, God, please don't ask me. Tell me.
It's Bastille Day.
Oh, Bastille Day. Of course, I forgot.
Commemorates the French Revolution in 1789.
Right.
And it's a big French fiesta annually, yeah, to be shared on the diplomatic circuit with sophisticated ostentation that France is famed for. So embassies and capitals around the world invite local dignitaries who are treated to French cuisine, hospitalité française, and Gallic élan, you know, that's sort of bonjour, ben, you know, like this. And so in Yerevan last week, this didn't go well.
Beaucoup de croissants.
They ate their canapés and their vol-au-vent, and guests, almost without exception, were convulsed at short notice by the urgent need for an insufficient number of lavatories.
Oh, God.
there was apparently immediate food poisoning.
Oh.
Just reminds me of the last scene of the Grand Bouffe. Did you ever see
that? I didn't. It's not the sort of film I wanted to see, really.
Not your sort of film. The 1973 classic where a pilot, a TV star, and a judge eat themselves to death.
Yeah, gross gluttony.
Quelle démarche. And talking of gluttony, last Saturday, the 4th of July, on New York's Coney Island, battling not only other competitors but extreme heat. The annual Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest witnessed a man called Joey Jaws Chestnut score his 18th mustard belt win by eating no fewer than 66 hot dogs in, wait for it, just 10 minutes.
Oh, for heaven's sake. And is he in hospital as well?
No, he did survive to tell the tale. He was actually a little bit disappointed because his record of 76 hot dogs in 2021 remains unbroken. And he blames the heat, the effects of which were far from appetizing, because at one point during the competition, a commentator observed sweat dripping down Joey's forehead, off the tip of his nose, and into the hot dog and mustard mix that he was cramming into his mouth.
This is disgusting.
I'm not looking for an excuse, said Chestnut, but yeah, the heat did slow me down. But hey, it's a dream. It's electric. There is no better place on earth. I am champion in America's most patriotic sport. That was his comment, having won the mustard belt. In the 2024 champion, Patrick Bertoletti came in second with 51 hot dogs. And get this, the undefeated women's champion, Miki Sudo, won her 12th title with 38.75 hot dogs.
She
finish that last quarter.
They must all be absolutely enormous and disgusting, are they not?
Well, there was a picture of Chestnut. Sadly, I couldn't get a video of him actually scoffing these hot dogs.
Why would you want to?
I'm just interested in his technique, because let's just focus for a moment on the achievement of Joey Jaws Chestnut. To win Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest, he has to put away a hot dog every 9 seconds for a whole 10 minutes.
And this is in a horrible white bun. In the bun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a hot dog, yeah, you know.
With mustard?
Basically, lots of mustard, yeah, and sweat, in his case, dripping off the end of his nose.
Where do you find these things, Kit?
Well, it's research, Jenny.
It's research.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Valuable stuff.
En Camino research.
Scientific.
Next on the En Camino news, heading north into Canada now, because Canadians are polite, as Ottawa police are politely advising citizens of the Canadian capital to please not bring live grenades into police stations.
Makes
after
sense.
A well-meaning, though possibly retarded man, brought an undetonated World War II grenade into an Ontario constabulary for disposal. While happily the 80-year-old device did not choose this moment to explode, Ontario Provincial Police made the following statement. The OPP would like to remind members of the public that if you find such items as undetonated grenades, please don't transport them to your local police station. This could prove a danger to the person bringing in the unexploded ordnance and to others, like us, in the vicinity. Please leave it where you find it. Call us and we'll come to you.
Oh. So what I want to know, Kit, is what happened to the diplomats who were all made ill by their delicious poisoned canapes?
Well, they went to the lavatory.
That's all. Okay, so they've recovered.
I don't know. I mean, it made the news, so presumably there was some sort of hoo-ha about it. I imagine the chef got into trouble.
Probably. Horrendous idea.
Yeah.
And there's nothing worse than being in a public place and having, you know, you're having to socialise and look proper and everything, and you feel so ill you have to rush to the toilet.
Yeah, I think probably etiquette was left by the door. You know, people were literally clutching their stomachs. There was something very bad in the Armenian salad or whatever it was. Mm. Here in Spain, a British man of 86 has been injured at San Fermin, the Pamplona Bull Run. Have you seen that on the telly?
What a surprise.
Yes, and our sympathies go out to him, do they? 57 people were hurt during the 8-day event, which has claimed the lives of 16 people in the past 116 years, the last of whom was Daniel Jimeno Romero, who was fatally gored in the neck and lung in 2009. The festival of San Fermin was immortalised by Ernest Hemingway in his 1926 novel The Sun Also Rises, which tells the story of a boozy bunch of Americans lodging it in Pamplona. Here is Ernest at the Bull Run in San Fermin. The stretch of ground from the edge of town to the bull ring was muddy. There was a crowd all along the fence that led to the ring. And outside, the balconies and the tops of the bull ring were solid with people. I heard the rocket, and I knew I couldn't get into the ring in time to see the bulls come in, so I shoved through the crowd to the fence. I was pushed close against the planks of the fence. Between the two fences of the runway, the police were clearing the crowd along. They walked or trotted on into the bull ring. Then people commenced to come running. A drunk slipped and fell. Two policemen grabbed him and rushed him over the fence. The crowd were running fast now. There was a great shout from the crowd, and putting my head through the boards, I saw the bulls just coming down the street onto the long running pen. They were going fast and gaining on the crowd. Then another drunk started up from the fence with a blouse in his hands. He wanted to do cape work with the bulls. The two policemen tore out, collared him, one hit him with a club, and they dragged him against the fence and stood flattened out against the fence as the last of the crowd and the bulls went by. There were so many people running ahead of the bulls that the mass thickened and slowed up, going through the gate into the ring as the bulls passed, galloping together, heavy, muddy-sided, horns swinging. One shot ahead caught a man in the running crowd in the back and lifted him into the air. Both the man's arms were by his side. His head went back as the horn went in, and the bull lifted him and then dropped him. The bull picked up another man running in front, but the man disappeared into the crowd, and the crowd was through the gate and into the ring with the bulls behind them. The red door of the ring went shut. The crowd on the outside balconies of the bull ring were pressing through to the inside. There was a shout, and then another shout. The man who had been gored lay face down in the trampled mud. We later heard that he was dead.
Okay.
So, yeah.
The big question is...
the thoroughly butch...
Why?
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
It's still going on to this day.
It's insanity. Utter gory insanity and very cruel.
I love it that... lest anyone call the unreconstructed macho Hemingway a chauvinist. You'll enjoy this, Janie. Mm. This is from another book he wrote about bulls called This Dangerous Summer. Pamplona, which is where the bull run is.
Yeah. It also happens in your town, though, doesn't it, Gaucine?
Nothing on that scale.
Okay.
Ernest is saying Pamplona is no place to bring your wife. The odds are all in favour of her getting ill, hurt or wounded, or at least jostled and wine squirted all over her, or of losing her. Maybe all three. If anyone could do Pamplona successfully, it would be my friends Carmen and Antonio, but Antonio wouldn't bring her. It's a man's fiesta, and women at it make trouble. Never intentionally, of course. They nearly always make trouble. I wrote a book about this once. Of course, if she can talk Spanish, she knows she's being joked with and not insulted. If she can drink wine all day and all night and dance with any groups of strangers who invite her. If she doesn't mind these things being spilled on her. If she addresses the continual noise and music and loves fireworks, especially those that fall close to her or burn her. If she thinks it is sound and logical to see how close you can come to being killed by bulls for fun and for free. If she doesn't catch a cold when she's rained on and appreciates dust, likes disorder and irregular meals and never needs to sleep and still keeps clean and neat without running water, then maybe bring her. You'll probably lose her to a better man than you.
Oh, I would say so, definitely. Oh, how ridiculous. Yes, but he's got it, though, hasn't he?
The immortal words of, Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. Right, well, we're going to take another break now, and we'll see you after these messages. With our feature, Time for Grow. Things that grow. Time to grow. Yeah. Right, we'll take a break. We'll see you after this.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Well, Paul Crosby has actually sent us a video of of Joey Jaws Chestnut, the champion hot dog eater, which we'll enjoy watching after the show. Thanks very much for that, Paul. Now, moving away from eating hot dogs into the more refined area of restaurants. Are you a tricky customer, I wonder? Janie, do you think you're a tricky customer in a restaurant?
No, I think I'm a good customer. What about you?
I'm definitely not tricky. I don't like cold soup when it's supposed to be hot.
No, that's true.
Generally, I sit there and take it like a sort of English person does, without complaining. I'm probably slightly less tolerant than I was. But I think you're quite annoying in restaurants.
Oh, thank you very much.
Sort of like, can I have honey instead of sugar? Kind of question. Have you got a nub of ginger? That kind of thing.
You know,
it's just like, it's slightly squirmy to be with you in a restaurant. Sometimes, not all the time. But
Very recently, recall, in fact, last weekend on the Saturday, us sitting in a restaurant and having our lunch. And it was only a snacky lunch. We had taco chips and guacamole. Do you remember?
I do.
And there was just a tiny amount of guacamole.
They were super tight on the guacamole.
I asked for some more. And so they brought more, which they then added to the bill.
I absolutely endorse that. Yeah.
But what I do recall you saying is, I'm never coming here again.
Did I say that?
You actually did, yes.
Well, time will tell as to whether.
So it takes
won't
to
be ordering guacamole and nacho chips again.
€9
for a thimbleful of guacamole and surrounded by a sort of...
A whole packet of tacos emptied onto the plate,
wasn't it?
Completely agree. Yeah. It was worth complaining about. And we did, actually. Yeah.
Maybe it was just a bad choice. But here's an article that I enjoyed. It comes from the FT, the Financial Times. It's by a guy called Ajesh Patale. And it says, it's entitled, "Are You a Tricky Customer? The Customer is Always Right," used to be the founding principle of good service. Well, not anymore, says hospitality expert Nick Clark, who goes on to say, traditionally, staff have been seen as subservient, especially in high-end restaurants. And certain restaurants play up to that with an absolutely style of service. But this creates the potential for problems. People tend to go into high-end restaurants with a degree of discomfort. They might be meeting their boss or they might be on a date, and uncomfortable people tend to kick off. We teach staff how to... We teach staff how to read the energy and change it by responding appropriately. Not something you can do if you're subservient.
No.
So it's about handling entitled customers.
Have you ever been a waiter in a restaurant?
No, I never have. I did work in a restaurant, but I was put on pot duty. They kept me in the back.
Well, I've been a waitress many a time.
And how's your
experience? I actually quite enjoyed it because most of my guests, the diners, were very pleasant to me. And I do remember once being in Australia, and it was New Year's Eve, I think it was. And they were the only customers. There were only two customers, and they'd ordered these enormous steaks. They took over an hour to arrive. These poor people were sitting there starving. I had to keep going out and apologising. I didn't know what was going on. But they were so kind to me when the food did eventually come. They gave me a huge tip.
That's very nice.
Embarrassing and awkward, but my experience of waitressing was actually all right.
Great, that's great. Because Adam Hyman of Code, a network for the hospitality industry, says there's an element of people who look down on workers in the service industry. Brits, in particular, are very good at being entitled. At the same time, everyone lives their lives at a million miles an hour. Everything is very transactional, and going out for drinks and dinner is not cheap. All of this plays a role in how people behave. So there's a number of changes that have happened in the restaurant scene, as I understand it. Devices. They've become a source of contention.
Like what?
Well, like 10 years ago, the idea of somebody getting a laptop out at a restaurant.
Oh, those sorts of devices. That's what you meant, serving devices, like, you know, ice cream scoops and stuff like that.
No, we're sitting at the table, yeah.
Okay.
We get our devices out, yeah, which basically are laptops or your tablet or something like that. 10 years ago, that would have been unthinkable.
Mm.
And there are restaurants now, high-end restaurants, that ban devices. St. James Maison Francoise in Paris, outside mealtimes, laptops are allowed. At other times, we slide a business card onto the table with a request, discreetly printed on the back, to put your laptop away.
I think that's actually quite good.
Absolutely.
Because you go to a restaurant primarily to eat and socialise, don't you? Well, yes. One should.
Yes.
You know, even and if you're on your own.
I suppose this is a business lunch.
Yes, yes,
you might have recourse for your laptop.
I did see a bit of TV last night where this guy goes into a cafe, fairly empty cafe, and he plugs in everything he's got into the plug behind him. And the waitress says to him, "Can I get you anything?" And he says, "No, I'm fine, thanks." And he's literally using it as an office.
Right. And didn't even order...
No, didn't order anything.
Not even tap water?
No.
Well, that's not on. That's
no,
absolutely not on.
Not on.
A growing number of diners also these days turn up with dogs. Well, we've witnessed that, haven't we, at La Cantina in Guadalmina.
Yes.
And dogs can come. Dogs generally can come in, but feeding a dog at the table, not really.
Absolutely not.
No.
I do. I have a memory of someone feeding their dog at the table, but I won't go there. I also do have a recollection of being a waitress. Another experience in Australia, where I was waiting, and the customer in the dining room said, "I would like some double cream, please, on my apple pie or whatever it was." And so, and I said, "Oh, I'll go and get some." I went into the back and I said, "Where's the double cream?" I said, "We haven't got any. There's a tub we've just thrown in the bin because it's not fresh anymore." And I said, "Okay, I'll go and tell them." They said, no, just take it out and scoop some.
Did you sniff it?
I did actually do as I was told, and I left that day. I never went back.
Right, okay.
I didn't think that was right somehow.
We might have a French embassy situation going on there.
Have we got time for things that grow? Because I've got lots of things that grow.
Okay, Kate. Jenny, we've got 2 minutes for things that grow.
Shall we leave out the little jingle?
We'll leave out the painful theme music, yeah.
Yeah, I could just sing it slightly, Kelly.
We plough the fields and scatter.
Okay,
the
that's enough.
Right. On the land. Welcome to this week's the part of the show we call Things That Grow. Janie, what have we got that's growing?
Well, I think the human population here. I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous. It's absolutely jammed.
Are you
full
talking
of
about a summer influx?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we've had 36.8 million international tourists arriving in this country this is Malaga, actually, since January. Okay, January, that's January to May. And now we're expecting it. We haven't even got to the end of July and they cannot produce the figures yet, but that's over 10 million for down here at Malaga Airport already. It is utterly insane.
One wonders if the heat might drive them off, particularly at this time of year.
One would think so. But there's some joyful sides to this. I mean, there are apartments going up, absolutely sprouting everywhere, growing like mushrooms.
What's joyful about that?
Nothing at all. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, there's at least 300 that have appeared along my road, which is like a bit of a rural road as well. Petrol prices, of course, have gone up. I mean, that's just a normal thing, up and down as it goes. But also down on the beach, Kit, I went there the other day and had such fun. It was the dog beach and the dogs were having a hell of a party.
But you don't have a dog.
I don't have a dog.
But you just went there anyway.
I just painted a picture of a dog that I love and the picture came out really, really well. And I thought, I want some more photographs of dogs.
Okay.
So I walked down the beach and it was just heavenly fun and joy and leaping in the water and chasing balls and all the dogs are different sizes. It's such amusement. I mean, I could have spent all day there just lapping it up.
I can't wait to get down there with whatever new dog I get, which I will be getting another dog.
But it really is a joyful place to be.
Yeah, yeah. So it'd be brilliant seeing dogs social and playing together.
It is.
Yeah. Well, that's it for today. We are out of time. It's been a great pleasure having your company. Wish you a very happy weekend.
Lovely to speak to you all.
From Janie and I.
Adios. Have a great weekend.
Yes. Hasta la semana que viene.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.